So can I dispense with this? Can you guys in the back hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Are you serious? I knew that. The dude told me that he's recording it. But you don't need this for the recording, do you? Oh, okay. Well, the royalty just changed, okay, Doc? By the way, I appreciate the invitation, John. It's fun to be here. Sorry for stealing Bob Birgeneau. He's good. He's great, actually. So apologize for that. And he's part of our bigger group of people working on complex oxides and stuff. And it seems like the Bell Labs management has reassembled in California. You know, we have Bob Dines as the Supreme Commander. We have Steve Chu on the right side. We have Cherry Murray at Livermore. She's the number two person there. So things are pretty good for physics, I think, for the next few years at least. You know. When John asked me to give this talk, I had a slightly different plan, and I kind of toned it down a little bit because this is a colloquium. And so please feel absolutely free to hit me on the head, say, Doc, you're going too fast, you're full of it, whatever it is, you know, we can ask these guys to do some quick edits on the video if it's needed and stuff like that. What I wanted to discuss today with you all is the excitement in this field, and this is really mainly meant at the students. And there is a lot of fun stuff going on. There's a lot of nano going left and right, bio going left and right. And these complex materials are on the same track. There's a lot of fun stuff going on. Whether you're an engineer trying to make devices out of these, for example, a memory device, or whether you're a physicist trying to understand correlations between electrons. How do they talk to each other? Do they talk to each other? The good thing about these systems is the fact that they're almost very much like human beings, you know. Some of them like each other. Some of them hate each other. Some of them like each other of the same color. And all of these different variants come into play. And so it's a very fascinating business. If you study human beings, you enjoy the whole process. I think complex oxides give you the same kind of richness in scientific detail. So what I'm hoping to get across to you is some of the excitement. And so the talk is basically in three segments. The first 10-15 minutes is to give you an overview, some of the material systems, and it's not meant to be in great detail of any one topic, just to tell you what has happened in the past, why is it that we're talking about these systems. And then slowly we will go on to one particular topic where I want to focus on, and I will explain to you hopefully why it is so exciting at this point, and then summarize with some of the conclusions. If you would like to get more of the details, again, this is free. John just gave me $10, but free advertisement for his workshop that he's running tomorrow. Some more details will be talked about tomorrow. Okay. So with that, let's begin by asking the question, so what's a big deal? What are we looking at? What you're looking at here is what the material scientists, people would call the thermodynamic phase space, for example. The coupling between order parameters, the polarization, and which is the intrinsic parameter, and how it changes with an external field, electric field in this case. This is very well studied. You know, people have looked at ferroelectrics for ever since Rochelle salt was discovered. Coupling between magnetism and magnetic field has been extensively studied as well. I mean, we have a $200 billion industry in the recording industry alone, which is driven by this coupling. We'll understand quite a bit about them. This coupling is also very well understood. Steels, martensitic steels, are all based on this understanding. The coupling between these guys, between electric field and strain, or stress and polarization, is the basis for piezoelectricity. So that's also very well understood. This coupling is also reasonably understood. Not many devices are in place. For example, magnetic shape memory alloys use the coupling between strain and magnetic field, or a stress and the magnetization. The coupling between polarization and magnetic field, or magnetization and electric field, has not been really studied from a very detailed point of view. So we're going to try to focus on that in the last 20-25 minutes of this presentation. In the process of doing that, I want to also tell you some materials issues. For example, what are the complexities of the system? And this is, again, like real life, nothing is easy, okay? There's a lot of the different things, and again, I see a few Indian faces in the audience, and I can't help make this joke about, it's not a joke, it's a statement of fact. I'm sure you guys have seen this Indian movies, right? Indian movies are made to cater to everybody. There's some of this violin playing. This is tear jerkers for people like my mom who need to see that to get their satisfaction. I can't stand all those things at all. I need to see some heavy-duty fighting and all of these things, mindless violence. And that is there, 20 minutes of mindless violence, the hero fighting the villain and stuff. And for all the romantic types, there's this triangle which is going back and forth, you know, so you have... Yeah. So these systems also give you the same kind of jollies. You can have... It's affirmative action for everybody. You know, it's equal opportunity for everybody. Nobody's spared the misery. Okay, so again, I'm just a spokesperson for a bunch of people. Again, you see a lot of people who were in my group at Maryland. The extended group at Maryland was a really very interactive group, which kind of got disbanded a little bit over the last few years. A lot of different people. That's our, I hate to use the word trademark, but we love to collaborate with people. Because in the end, it's really not about the science. The science is actually secondary. It's the human interaction which is more important. Okay. So you enjoy the certain, of course, sometimes you get pissed off and stuff like that, but really it's this is an interaction with each other. That you, oh, you know what? I learned something from somebody. Oh, I really like hanging out with these guys. That's really the most important thing that you take away from this whole process. Okay, a quick summary, maybe 5-10 minutes of the physics of highly correlated oxides. Again, this is a very, very complicated business. I don't pretend to be the expert on this field, but I've just tried to tell you what the interesting issues are, at least. Then go into multiparoxides as an example of what we can do with these kinds of materials. Okay, for those who have not seen these kinds of oxides, I mean, this is kind of a very quick tutorial. The prototypical systems within a family called the perovskites is shown here. That's the cubic perovskite system. The basic building block is an octahedral coordination of oxygen. That's kind of the template that everything else is built on. And then you can insert cations, for example, the A-side cations, which generally is the bigger 8-fold coordinated cation, for example, lead or lanthanum in the manganites, etc. At the body center, you will have the smaller cation. Typically, the transition metal sits there. That can be manganese, for example, in the manganites, titanium in these perovskite titanates, and so on and so forth. So that gives you the basic architecture, one of the architectures, actually, because there is another architecture which has a layered structure. And this is the parent compound of the high-temperature superconductor, the bismuth-based superconductor. And the key difference between these two guys is that in addition to these so-called perovskite blocks, which you can think of these pieces of cheese that you slide in, you have these bismuth oxide-type planes. These have sodium chloride-like packing structure in contrast to the perovskite-like structure. And they give this system a very strong sense of two-dimensionality. They're almost like mica. And therefore, the properties are very anisotropic, as you know in the high-TC materials. The coherence length, everything is very anisotropic. Transport is anisotropic. The interesting thing about perovskites, or just the subclass of oxides, is just in that family, you can have a huge bandwidth of physical properties. You have superconductivity, you have colossal magnetoresistance, you have antiferromagnets, ferromagnets, name it, you got everything. The most interesting thing, which we'll come to in just one second, is the tunability in these properties. Okay, remember that perovskites are just one part of the spectrum. You could have spinels, for example. You can have pyrochlores. You can have layered structures. You can have rock salt type structures. So therefore, these families of oxides give you a very nice toy kit to play games with. Okay, many different kinds of spices can be added to it in terms of doping. Now, let's ask some basic questions, okay? We're now focusing on one of these, the perovskite family. This is a prototypical, the canonical structure, where you have the oxygen octahedra there, the A side and the B side. And this is now flipped over. The manganese is now sitting at the corners of the inner cell, but basically it's the same structure, okay? And that's the first, it's the first illustration in a thin film of this whole business of colossal magnetoresistance. Again, it showed that you can have very large tunability in the transport properties, very, very highly sensitive to fields. Not only magnetic fields, as shown here, but also to other perturbations. And we'll see that in a second. Okay? The other characteristic feature of these systems that you want to take away is the fact that the properties of these materials, which we'll just see in one second, are very sensitive to the orbital, the lattice, the charge on the electron, for example, the 3D electron, as well as the spin of the electron. So all of them are playing a role, and therefore you could have some very exotic phases that start forming in these systems. Okay. So So there's one question that we will address at the end of the presentation. I do hope you have time for that. The other thing that comes up, and this came up about 8 to 10 years ago when we were doing some very careful measurements, or we were trying to do some careful measurements of the magnetic properties of these materials. What were we trying to look at? We were trying to look at, in some sense, the band structure of this material and say, how does it look like compared to a regular metal? And these materials, this manganites, for example, doped manganites, behave like half-metallic systems, in which sense one of their bands has electrons of one polarization, let's say spin-up band. The other band has no electrons at all. And so these materials are highly spin-polarized. And the calculations have shown that these materials should be at 100% spin-polarized below their transition temperature. We said, okay, let's look at one of these samples. This is lanthanum strontium manganese oxide, which has a transition temperature of about 380 Kelvin. And you say, okay, if I have a 380 K sample, at any temperature below that, I should get 100% spin polarization. And you can measure this in so many different ways. One way to do it is just by doing a magnetic measurement, which is kind of a macroscopically average value of the polarization of the sample, which is shown here. The other way, where you sample maybe 10 to 20 nanometers of a material, in this case a thin film, is to do circular dichroism. We'll go back and define or look at this dichroism business a little bit more detail later on. You can see that that's not the same as a macroscopic measurement telling you something has happened at the surfaces. You can go a little bit more at the surface, which is spin polarized photoemission spectroscopy, which really samples the first few unit cells. You can see that the magnetization in that layer is dramatically suppressed. And this actually has turned out to be a very important point with these material systems. They're very susceptible to chemical and structural perturbation. The properties can be dramatically different. So if you wanted to build a device which would use these materials' properties, namely the high spin polarization, you first have to address these things very carefully. So with that, we can just quickly summarize the basic physics of this animal. What is the physics of this animal? You have manganese, for example, with these four electrons. These three electrons really are electronically alert, inert. They don't really, they're the core structure, if you want to think of it. They don't really play a very big role. The key electron that is jumping around is this EG electron, and that can be changed. The concentration of that electron can be changed, for example, by doping the lanthanum manganite, which has manganese only in plus 3 state, by putting in calcium. And that's what gives you, in some sense, a concentration of carriers. Okay. And so these guys can hop from one side to the other, but the hopping is very, very strongly controlled by a few factors. For example, the kinetic energy of this electron, which gives you some measure of the ability to hop, is controlled by this misorientation angle, and therefore if the spins are all aligned absolutely parallel, then you have a very good chance that this will hop. It behaves very much like a metal. This angle can be tuned by strain, by electric fields, or magnetic fields for that matter. Okay. So one of the consequences of this is the fact that you can have competing phases. You can have ferromagnetic phases, which have high kinetic energy and therefore are metallic. We can have paramagnetic or antiferromagnetic phases, which are insulating in behavior. And these are all very sensitive to perturbations. I'll show you one quick example of how perturbations change it dramatically. So a summary of the various things. The hopping of the electron can be changed by perturbations, first point. The tunability of the kinetic energy of this electron without composition change, keeping everything else fixed, is a very interesting feature of these systems. And one of the kind of spin-offs of this is the fact that these materials are not electronically homogeneous. They can be electronically very inhomogeneous, i.e. they can be phase separated on not on a chemical basis, but on an electronic basis. Okay? And you can use the tunability as another window to understand how these correlated electrons behave in these complex materials. And we already talked about the surfaces. Now, one of the experiments that you can do, in addition to the so-called colossal magnetoresistance, you can also have a colossal electroresistance, telling you that you have the ability to perturb with electric fields, magnetic fields, and other fields. So what you see here is basically the same sample, lanthanum calcium manganite, with a ferroelectric as a contact layer. By switching the ferroelectric from one state to the other, from the up state to the down state, you can create various surface charge densities that can modulate the carrier concentration in this very thin manganite layer. And therefore, you can get various resistivity curves, A, B, C, and D, with the electric field, without the electric field, with the electric field, and the combination of both electric and magnetic fields. Telling you that you have a system which is very inhomogeneous. This is the whole concept of having electronic phase separation. There are regions which can be tuned with electric fields. There are regions in the sample which can be tuned by magnetic fields, and they both add up, which is what is shown here in the insert. And it's just to illustrate that this then becomes a knob. You can then start to understand the properties of these systems using these kinds of approaches. Okay, so now I'm going to give you a quick summary. We're at the half an hour mark already. Some of the fundamental science, clearly not the whole shooting match, but at least to outline to you what the things can that we can look at. What I want to now focus on is this business of understanding coupling of order parameters. Let's pause for the moment and go back to the first view graph where we showed this triangle. Okay, we said that, look, the coupling between the direct order parameters, namely the extrinsic and the intrinsic variables, is reasonably well understood. We can understand magnetism, how it changes with magnetic field. But what is not understood is what happens if I have multiple order parameters. Just like schizophrenia is such a nasty thing to understand from a human sense, these kinds of properties where you have two different order parameters, and the one we're going to focus on today is a material where you have a ferroelectric, a polarization order parameter, coupled with a magnetic, namely an antiferromagnetic order parameter. Can they talk to each other? If I change one of them, will the other one change? This is a very interesting new direction. Of course, in all of these, you can have many other problems to chase. The physics of finite size effects is a very interesting area as well. Dynamics of domains is a very interesting area as well. And we clearly will not have time for all of them. So this kind of summarizes what I told you just a couple of minutes ago. What is a multiferroic? A multiferroic, in simple sense, you can just say it has multiple order parameters. Ferromagnetism, for example, ferroelectricity, ferroelasticity, and more exotic degrees of order where you have a toroidal moment which gives you some kind of a toroidal moment along one direction, spins which are in some kind of a toroid. Now, in oxides, it's quite easy to look for ferroelectrics, and this was some very nice work done by Nicholas Paulden early on in 99-2000, where she asked a very simple question. How do I go about doing a categorization of ferroelectrics? And you can actually do it now by first principle calculations. By the way, from the student's point of view, that's the other message I would like you to take away, that these materials are so complicated that you want the interplay between the experimentalists and the theorists. One of the biggest things I've learned is by arguing or by discussing with our theory friends as to what is it that we can learn from them. And it's a huge amount of stuff that you can leverage by just talking to the theory folks. Okay. One of the things that Nicola said was, look, if you want to have ferroelectricity, you have a few design algorithms. I can go into a lead titanate crystal, a crystal of lead titanate, which looks like so. Let me just draw it for you as a reference point. So I have the titanium sitting at the body center. And these are the lead. And the reason this works is quite simple. Actually, it's not that simple, but we can simplify it quite a bit by going through the following set of arguments. First, you want a system which has D0. Electronic configuration. There are no floating electrons, nothing that can be stripped off from the cation. So titanium plus 4 satisfies that very well. Okay. The second thing you want is a structure where this titanium is actually rattling around, where it has some space, so at some temperature or at some field, electric field preferably, or mechanical field, it can condense into one structure. This is the so-called soft mode transition, which doesn't necessarily happen in lead titanate, but that's the general thinking process. The other thing which is really interesting, which is an important point, is the fact that these guys said, look, I could take the same system, I could replace lead by barium. And barium titanate is also a good ferroelectric, but its polarization is not as large. It's about 25 microcoulombs per centimeter squared, while lead titanate is about 100 microcoulombs per centimeter squared. These guys said, why does that happen? And the reason that happens is now reasonably well understood, is the fact that the electronic structure of these atoms, like lead or bismuth, is very susceptible to high polarizability. The 6s2 electrons, which are the outermost electrons, are very highly polarizable. Therefore, you have the second design algorithm, which says, look, I want to have cationic species in my structure which are highly polarizable, so I could then start using that as a source of ferroelectricity. Okay. So you have two criteria. One is to have a D0-ness, which is important, for example, in barium titanate, and the 6s2 electrons, which comes in lead titanate. The unfortunate problem is if you say now superimpose the requirement that there is ferromagnetism, there are not too many compounds. It turns out there are very few compounds which have both. The reason is that once you ask for ferromagnetism in these oxides, you have to ask the question, what is the mechanism by which coupling happens? And in most cases, the coupling is mediated through the oxygen, the very classical super-exchange mechanism. And in consequence of the super-exchange mechanism is the fact that the moments in the transition metal, if there is a moment, titanium doesn't have one, if there is a moment, have to couple antiferromagnetically. Okay. So that gives you kind of a quick perspective. Let me skip this because that's just a little bit more details on the coupling phenomenon. So, ergo, here's a compound which seems to have all of these properties. It actually is a very nice model system. I'll explain to you why. Because, again, like the Indian movie story I told you, this has got a lot of different nuances to it. It's got a lot of intrigue. There's a lot of controversies and everything else that you need to make life interesting. Okay. So the structure is, again, a very classical perovskite structure. Bismuth sitting at the A side, iron at the B side, and the oxygen octahedral. It undergoes a ferroelectric phase transition at a very high temperature of about 800 degrees centigrade. Okay? But in the past, people had made it in crystal form, albeit not in very high quality, and they showed a very low polarization. And there's a whole bunch of people in the 60s and 70s, especially in Russia, they're saying, guys, this doesn't make sense at all. I have a material which has a very high transition temperature, which has a very, very small polarization. It's totally out of whack with lithium niobate or lead titanate or any of the other compounds that you could compare it with. That was the first point, which is a big bone of contention. The other point is that, as I mentioned to you like 5 minutes ago, that the iron which is sitting, iron is in the D3, is in a plus 3 state, it's a D5 system. And so it looks semi-inert. It's not really a D0 system, but it looks like that because it's of the high-spin iron state, which is typically the state for iron in these cases. So what happens is that when this iron couples to this iron antiferromagnetically, and therefore the material by itself is a good antiferromagnet. If that were the story, everything is reasonably understandable. But because of some other complicated interactions, which we will not go into the details of, there is a very small magnetic moment because of the canting of the moments. This is something, again, if you want to get into the oxide magnetic business, you got to get used to things not being perfectly aligned with some crystallographic axes. Typically, these two magnetic moments, which are 111 planes, are slightly canted with respect to each other. The canting angle is about a degree or so. That leads to a very small magnetic moment. Okay. So the questions we started asking is, why is it that the ferroelectric polarization is so low? And so let's begin by looking at how one can address that. Now, our skill base is not growing crystals. And again, you guys have a very nice capability here to grow high-quality crystal. I wish we had that. But what we can do very rapidly is grow thin films of the material. And it's kind of a legacy of the work that we did in the HITC and the ferroelectrics and the CMR field that we can now transfer all of this very rapidly. So the algorithm is a very, very well-established algorithm. We use a single crystal of strontium titanate as our substrate, like you'd use silicon, for example. We use a conducting oxide like strontium ruthenate as an electrode, which turns out is a very important part of the technology of these ferroelectric materials. And then we grow these guys epitaxially. You can see that the commonality in crystal structure facilitates heteroepitaxy. That's the other thing that I want you to take away, that you now have with these materials very complicated but very rich phase space, but you can control their crystal structure and in some sense their properties by growing them heteroepitaxially. Pretty much what you can do with semiconductor materials. Okay. The first message is that the bulk material is rhombohedral in structure, distortion along the 111 crystallographic direction, while these thin films tend to have additional distortions because of heteroepitaxy. It can either be the devil or it can be a friend for you, depending on what you want to do with this. These distortions generally change the properties of the system as well. They can go, I will not spend too much time on this view graph because it's just a trust me view graph, okay? It tells you that we can grow high quality materials. You can see they're very, very highly crystalline. That's the bismuth iron oxide sitting on top of strontium ruthenate. If you have the resolution in your electron microscope, you can map out the atomic positions. And in this case, this is a 1 angstrom resolution electron microscope that you can actually say, look, this distortion is actually indeed the atomic distortions in the crystal. And you can map it out very, very carefully as a function of thickness. But the key point I wanted to make is that you now have the ability to image these kinds of structures directly in real space. Okay, a very quick summary, and this again is nothing to do with the physics of the system, but it tells you that physics has to be done, in my mind at least, within the framework of some global thing. And let me give you a good example of what I mean by this, okay? I've been working on PZT, lead-based photoelectric, for the last 15 years maybe, okay? About 2-3 years ago, the EU folks decided that they can't afford to have lead anywhere. And so as of July of this year, there will be no lead in any open circuits. If you have lead solders, for example, in microelectronics, you've got to take it out. Of course, there's no lead anymore in our gasoline anyway. So the message there is that if you have open lead, forget it. You've got to get it out. So every major corporation, Hitachi, everybody you can think of, HP, for example, I found this out from a friend of mine who is now a big director of sales at HP. She said, oh, we can't do anything with lead at all. I was trying to get money from her to do ferroelectrics. So the message was that we've got to try one at least, you know. And the message is that it has nothing to do with the properties or the science of PZT. We had figured out everything about the reliability, how to make it very, very good quality, endurance, blah, blah, blah. But somebody decided that you can't have lead. And by the way, the PZT film would be in an IC. It's not going to be sitting outside. But it's nothing to do with the reality either. It's to do with the mindset that these people have. They figured out that lead is going to be a problem now. So any lead which is in the open is basically gone as of July 06. In 10 years from now, lead everywhere will probably be gone, though. So it had nothing to do with the science. It had to do with global policy, okay? And we had to be sensitive to that. So we are very rapidly transitioning from a lead-based system into these newer systems, okay? So that's kind of the footnote, whatever you want to take from that. But it's very important because it changes the way we do research, though. But the key, the good thing in all of this is that if you're creative enough and you're lucky enough, you can find a system like this bismuth iron oxide, which actually shows a very large ferroelectric polarization. You can grow it on silicon wafers, thanks to some really nice work done at Motorola, where you can get huge wafers, 8-inch wafers of silicon coated with 100 angstroms of strontium titanate by MBE processes. Perfect wafers. They can grow epitaxial films of these materials on the surface. They're piezoelectric, and therefore that's another opportunity for future research because you could replace all of the piezoelectric devices that you have with these lead-free materials. So this is a major development for the technology part if we can figure out how to fix some of the technology-related issues, which is what we're working on. Next view graph is basically to tell you how first principles theory really helped us a lot, or vice versa, how we helped theorists. The reason this is so important is when we got these large polarization values, again, this is a big story, because for 1999 fall, we started this program. By the summer of 2000, we had this large polarization, and I was very uncomfortable because everybody else before us had said, look, the polarization is only about 3 microcoulombs. We were turning around, we were saying 60 microcoulombs of polarization. And so I kept on telling the student that, look, go back, do it again. I don't think you know what you're doing, you know. Usual professor stuff, you know. But this guy got really mad with me. And he said, look, if you're that smart, why don't you go do it? You're a big measurement guy. And this is the moment of revelation that nobody wants to face up to, you know. You're the professor, and you think either you're going to go do the measurement or you're going to look like a monkey. So fortunately, you know, I have this nasty habit of doing a crazy Ivan once in a few days. You always suspect, oh, something bad is going to happen, so you go back and do the measurement yourself. I still have this habit of doing that. So I went to the lab, did the measurement. We spent a few days, both the student and myself, going over various types of measurements. You do dynamic measurements, very fast measurements. You do the piezoelectric measurements. You look for all the order parameters with the piezoelectric and dielectric. Indeed, everything he had done was correct. And so, indeed, we had measured a large polarization. At the same time, we were talking to the theory guys, Nicholas Spalding, Karen Raybert-Rutgers, and the whole first principle crowd. Now, this made life a lot more difficult for a year after that, because when they did their first calculations on this system, the ground state they got was a metallic ground state. He said, guys, we were talking about a ferroelectric. What happened to that? And this, therein comes this whole business of doing this calculation. Again, I'm not a theorist, but I can only tell you what these Jeff Neaton and Nicola tried to explain to me. In correlated system, unlike lead titanate, where you can get the insulating ground state, no problem at all. You do a density functional theory, you put lead, titanium, oxygen, you do get a ferroelectric ground state. But when you have these iron-type systems, which have the d electrons, you can't just put them in and start shaking the computer and get the right ground state. You have to account for the interactions among the electrons. And therefore, what they had to do was to turn on this U parameter, which is the so-called on-site Coulombic repulsion parameter. It's kind of a, if you're very skeptical, you say it's a fudge parameter. In reality, what they're trying to do is saying, look, these electrons in the iron sublattice are not just oblivious of everybody else. They actually talk to each other. They're interacting with each other. And there's a repulsion that goes on. And you will see this again at the end of the presentation. So when they put that term in of about 5 electron volts or so, they did get a ground state which is insulating. They got a band gap of about 2.8 eV or so. The polarization values they got was about 90 microcoulombs. And it turns out in our measurement, we were looking at a projection of the polarization along the 100 direction in the crystal. And if you go back and look at our 111 oriented film, indeed we got 90 microcoulombs per centimeter squared polarization. So the large value made it very controversial, and this is still brewing. I mean, there's still a lot of arguments going back and forth saying, because there are people who think that there is another phase which has even higher polarization in these systems. Okay. Lot of discussion going on. Okay, I was going to talk a little bit about the magnetism, but really we don't have time, so I'm going to skip this. If you're interested, we'll talk about it tomorrow in the workshop. This is really another controversy which is to do with defects in these materials, so let's skip that. What I wanted to discuss is this very important question. I'm really very excited about this data. Again, being an experimentalist and going back to a place like Berkeley where you have this really nice facility, the synchrotron especially, has been, for me, it's like going back to a candy shop, okay? It's like, oh my God, this is so great, you know? It's like Christmas every day. So what are we trying to do here? The primary goal is to ask the question, if I switch my ferroelectric order parameter, let's say, For argument, it is sitting like so, and I switch it to the down state. And we can do that, right, by applying an electric field. The question is, what happens to the magnetic order parameter? What happens to antiferromagnetism? Again, bring back our friendly theorists. What they did was they, again, did a first principle calculations. What they concluded was, if these are the P is a polarization order parameter, D is a so-called Dialozhinsky-Moria parameter, which we will not go into details of, okay? Again, we can talk about this tomorrow. The M and the L describe the magnetic sublattices and the antiferromagnet. What they said was, if I switch my polarization from the dot to the cross, which is this 180-degree switch, nothing happens to the magnetism. As you can see, it's exactly the same state. So there's no change in the magnetism. So you really don't gain anything in this rhombohedral structure by a 180-degree switch of the polarization. What they didn't ask was, what if I did this by a totally different mechanism? That's a question we're going to ask right now. So this picture out here is kind of goofy, standing out there, but let me quickly take you through that. What we're trying to ask is, what happens if I take my polarization like this, and I shouldn't rotate it towards you guys, but, you know, a rhombohedral crystal has these four 111 directions. They're all equivalent. So I can take a polarization along the 111, and I can rotate it to the 11 bar 1. I can also rotate it to the 1 bar 1, and that will be the 71 degrees and 109 degree rotation of the polarization vector. The question then becomes, what happens to the antiferromagnetic planes, which are shown by these yellow and gray planes here, when I rotate the ferroelectric polarization? So they concluded, kind of from the theoretical point of view, that these antiferromagnetic planes should also start rotating. Okay. The question is, how does one probe these? And therein comes photo emission spectroscopy. So let me quickly take you through pictures of what I showed you. That's pretty much what we're talking about. Those are the three possible variants that one can switch into. So the question is, how does one look at the effect of that? So there are two different things I want you to take away, especially the students. One is the fact that you now have probes which can give you information about properties at, say, 10 to 20 nanometers. We do photo STM type work, even higher resolution. Here's an example of piezoelectric microscopy, which is very similar to magnetic force microscopy. You can take a crystal which is piezoelectric and take a metallized cantilever and oscillate it. That will deform the crystal, which is shown here. It will also, if there's a polarization vector in the plane, it will also torque the cantilever. And you can use that and quantitatively and qualitatively map out the polarization vector in the crystal in three dimensions. Okay. So let me quickly show you what we did with our actual sample. And here's some of the richness in these materials. This is an epitaxial sample of this bismuth iron oxide probed using the piezo force microscopy at three different length scales. You can see very rich domain structure, which we're going to analyze in just a second. Okay, the analysis of this actually didn't take a second. It took about 7 months for us, okay? So I will not take that much of time, except to tell you that you can look at the intensity distribution in the image in the out-of-plane deformation of the cantilever, as well as the in-plane deformation of the cantilever, and you can put it back together. It's like putting together a mystery novel, and you can map out the polarization vectors. In this particular sample, these were the preferred polarization. The 71 degrees polarization directions were very dominant. Okay. So that is kind of our starting point. Then the next question you ask is, what happens now if I switch them? You can do exactly the same experiment, but you take this metallized AFM tip and you apply a DC voltage to it. And it's like switching a capacitor, but on a very, very small scale. So you can have the original state. This is the out-of-plane image and the in-plane image. You can see that the out-of-plane has switched completely from the white state to the black state. The in-plane has also changed contrast. And again, part of the 6 months' effort was to ask the question, what does this change in contrast mean? The conclusion was that in this particular area, we have 180, 109, and 71-degree polarization switching. So then now comes the question, if this is happening in our film, can we now ask the question, what happens to the magnetic order parameter? And therein comes the photoemission spectroscopy. Again, I mentioned a few minutes ago, this is a very powerful tool. I'm not an expert in photoemission spectroscopy, but it's something that we're rapidly beginning to appreciate. Okay. A couple of things that you can do. You can do a lot of different things. There's a whole center which is dedicated to this. But you can do two kinds of experiments which is relevant to us. The first is so-called linear dichroism, which means you look at an absorption edge. This is the iron L2 edge, for example, in lanthanum iron oxide, which is a very nice anti-ferromagnetic material. Okay. Then you say, I use light of polarization this way or this way, which means 90-degree rotated and polarization. And I measured the same absorption edge, and you can see there is a difference. This is the dichroism with linearly polarized light. Okay. In the case of lanthanum iron oxide, what has been done already is that they have shown that this absorption dichroism is very systematically dependent on the antiferromagnetic order parameter. Therefore, at the nail temperature, it goes away. So you can use this to map out, in some sense, the antiferromagnetic order in a very local area. You can also do circular dichroism, which typically measures ferromagnetic component, which we will not talk about today. The other thing which is really powerful in this technique is that you can take this information and map it out using photoemission electron microscopy. You can scan a sample like so and get these various antiferromagnetic domains with a 20 nanometer or so resolution. So you can now see where we're heading. We can take the ferroelectric information from the piezoelectric images, superimpose on it magnetic information from the photoemission stuff. So I'm going to quickly take you through a set of images, not necessarily to go into the details. Here's a set of images. I want you to focus on this. This is the piezo force image of this area, showing this finger-like structure. You can see the same kind of fingers, a little bit darker contrast. This is blown up here. You can see the two different contrasts. What we've done is image the sample with the sample this way, rotated by 90 degrees, image it this way. So it gives you, in some sense, the polarization distribution with out-of-plane and in-plane imaging. You can do exactly the same experiment with linearly polarized light. Light coming in at this angle and light coming in at this angle just by rotating the sample. You can see exactly the same region is mapped out here, which shows a reversal in the contrast, telling you that the magnetic order parameter is also changing. So what we're now trying to do is to understand this better by doing temperature-dependent measurements. Why do we have to do that? The reason is because if a material is not antiferromagnetic, but it is just purely ferroelectric, any change, any asymmetry in the electron cloud distribution will lead to some kind of dichroism or some kind of difference in the absorption spectrum. So in our case, we have a complicated business of ferroelectricity and antiferromagnetism coexisting in the sample. So one way to separate it is by doing temperature-dependent measurements. For example, at the nail temperature of the antiferromagnet, you expect all the dichroism to go away. In our case, that's the temperature dependence of the dichroism. About 60% of it goes away at the nail temperature, telling you that you have about half and half contribution from magnetism and ferroelectricity. But by mapping out the structural order parameter with X-ray scattering techniques and the magnetic and the ferroelectric order parameter with the photoemission, you can separate these out. And therefore, you can carefully map out these things as a function of crystallographic orientation, temperature, and spatial location. So where are we now? We're now trying to use the same approach that I showed you. Write something electrically and probe what happens to it photoemission-wise to look for the signature of coupling. We believe that there is indeed coupling at a very, very microscopic scale, that if I switch my polarization from one direction to the other, the magnetization also changes. This is important because you can then do it with other optical techniques as well. And therefore, you can think of some applications which will use this. Okay, that just gives you a quick summary of what I just said. Let me just finish up with the last couple of view graphs. If you come to tomorrow's, if you are brave enough to come to tomorrow's workshop, we will talk about other ways of creating a multiferroid or a magnetoelectric material. Again, talking about crazy students, I think you want to have, again, this message is directly directed at the students, okay? Anytime your advisor says don't do something, at least half the time you got to do it, okay? Just don't assume the advisor is right, and I think this is a good example. Well, what happened was this girl had just come back from China. The U.S. government had given her a tough time. She was sitting there for 4 months. She didn't get her visa. She was a very frustrated person. She came back and said, look, I want to work on this. I've seen this paper in 1970 where they did dendritic growth of a ferromagnet embedded in a ferroelectric. I said, yeah, go ahead. We had been talking about it with my colleagues. I said, it's going to take you about several months to a year to do it. You know. In about 2 weeks, she came back with an AFM picture that I'll show you in just 1 second. But the idea is this, and this again comes back to epitaxy as a vehicle to create new materials. What are we trying to do? We're trying to use crystal chemistry, for example, a perovskite and a spinel. They both have the same building unit. They have the octahedra, which you can see very clearly, the oxygen octahedra. Except in the perovskites, they share them at the corners, while the spinels are edge sharing. So there's a change, slight change in symmetry. Because of that, the lattice parameters have a 2-to-1 ratio. But you can see many of the spinel materials are magnetic. They're very interesting systems as well. The goal was to grow a nanoscale cigarette box. Okay? If you can visualize a cigarette box, it's a rectangular box which has 5x5 array of cigarettes embedded in that. It's got translational order in 2 dimensions. And therefore, you can think of a nanoscale version of that which has these magnetic phases embedded in a matrix which is ferroelectric. So that's what we're shooting for, and that's what you saw in the first 2 to 3 weeks of our experiments. What you see here is an AFM cross-section of single crystalline pillars of cobalt ion oxide. That length scale is about 20 nanometers, perfectly down nanoscale. Very popular, very nice to market and stuff like that, but the science of it is really the most interesting thing. What you don't see here is the matrix, which is the ferroelectric phase, which you can see with electron microscopy. And we've done now, over the last couple of years, a lot of characterization. We now understand how this thing grows. It grows epitaxially, and we also understand the real mechanisms. The key point is that this shows some very interesting coupling behavior. So what is the question we're trying to ask? We're trying to ask the question, can I switch the state of magnetization of a magnet, not by applying a magnetic field, but by applying an electric field? Why is that so important? It's because every MRAM device that's being made, they're running huge amounts of current to create a magnetic field. And reality is that current translates to I squared R problems as well as powering issues. Somebody needs to make a battery to supply that current. So ideally, it would be a lot better if you could do it in a field mode. And electric fields are a lot more easier to contain. So the experiment that we're doing is one of these nanostructures, the black region out there is the ferroelectric matrix, while that white stuff there is the nanopillar, kind of a drifted image, but nevertheless, that's what it is. You can come in with the AFM, again, and switch the black to the white, which you see change in contrast, saying that the ferroelectric polarization has gone from this to this or vice versa. Okay? This is the magnetic force microscopy image of exactly the same area, mapped using, after it's been magnetized, you can see these white dots are the magnetic pillars. They're all magnetized with the magnetic vector pointing in one direction, let's say the up direction. And after we do this electric field switching, about 70% of them have switched the magnetization direction to the opposite direction. If you come tomorrow, we'll go through the details, the gory details of how we think this is happening, a lot of evidence to prove that indeed there is switching of the magnetization. Now the question is, how does this happen? How can we tune this? Can this happen again and again? We believe that this is very repeatable. You can go back, switch it back and forth. The question is, what is the mechanism by which this happens? We don't understand this well enough at this point. So with that, let me just leave this view graph up there as a summary view graph. The field of correlated electron materials, this broad class of materials, very exciting field. A lot of different things you can do with this. Us being thin film folks, we have two different algorithms, design algorithms. One we call the sandwich or the horizontal algorithm, where we can create interface electronic states, for example, between two insulators, two band insulators or two MOT insulators. Or we can create the so-called cigarette box, nanoscale cigarette box algorithm, design algorithm, by creating this vertical epitaxy. We can probe the coupling between the various degrees of freedom in the system by using these kinds of nanostructure geometries. So with that, thank you very much for this opportunity to visit here. I'll take questions if you have any. That's right. So the magnetization, below TC, in the sense, at some temperature below TC, they should split up. The real question was, should that happen at 30 degrees below the TC, or should it happen, like we see, at 300 degrees Kelvin below the TC?
But is that manifest itself as another phase transition?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. Should that happen like that when you go through the phase transition, or is there a much more different than the magnetic phase transition? What we were focusing on there was this business of the surface being much more different in terms of its magnetic behavior compared to the bulk. Good point. Sure. Okay, so fortunately enough, we think we figured it out, though. So here's this very simple picture, huh? If you look at what the material science folks call the Wolf construction, surface energy anisotropy mapping, for the spinel, it looks like so. I was just explaining this to Professor Desai, and he probably knows a lot more about this than I do, but anyway, I will explain to you. For the spinel, the Wolf construction is an octahedral. And so it looks like so. These are the 1-1-1 type planes. Okay. For the perovskites, for most cases, it's a square. These are the low energy surfaces. Okay, now let's look at a case where I have a perovskite surface. Let's say this is 100 perovskite surface. And I tried to put these guys down. So I'm raining down atoms from the spinel phase and the perovskite phase. Okay? So they kind of nucleate separately. And the spinel prefers to do this. This is a so-called winter bottom construction, which, okay, not to go into the details, the depth to which this is sunk is a measure of the surface energy, the interface energy. Okay. But the key point is that on a 100 perovskite surface, this guy prefers to grow like this, and this guy begins to facet. So the early stages of nucleation and growth of this nanostructure is governed very strongly by this very strong anisotropy in the surface energy for these two systems. And of course, this begins to propagate. They propagate this way, and they join up. Once they make contact, that interface between the perovskite and the spinel has to be a low-energy interface. It's typically the 1-1-0 type planes for the system. Okay. Now, you can also see that if I now change this to make this a 1-1-1 plane, which I can just draw by putting an angle of 54 degrees with this guy. I can just slide this over. Now this guy would then become something like this. And this guy would look something like this, crudely. Okay. And so it also turns out that if you use a 1-1-1 substrate, you can make a perovskite nanopillar in a spinel matrix just by changing the surface energies. That's a very simple level argument.
So the size difference for the terms of
temperature. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so then, the surface energy just gives you equilibrium. It doesn't say anything about how kinetics happen or how strain relaxation. We were kind of assuming that the mismatch is not a big player in that. Okay. Having said that, we know that already by going to just different surface temperatures, you can coarsen the structure. We can go from, say, 10 to 20 nanometers. We can even suppress the whole decomposition process, make it metastable and stuff. Yeah.
Can you just simply mention the microscopic interaction which allow you to change the magnetic ordering by the
That's a nasty question, but let's... That's good, good, it's good. We've been arguing about it. The reason I say it's nasty is because we've been arguing about this, okay? And we don't have insight into the actual mechanism that is happening. But let's the macroscopics of this is a little bit more easier to understand. So what is the argument? By switching the ferroelectric polarization, let's say, again, let me draw my usual unit cell. Let's say my atom is sitting there, the body-centered position. I move from this point to this point. And let's say this is 0.1 angstrom, okay, which is a good number for many. Let's say 0.05 to 0.1 angstrom. So I have a material where I have electrically moved this. So there's a displacement of the order of 0.05 to 0.1 angstrom of the body-centered atom position. So let's say the iron in this case. Okay. If you look at, this is the perovskite, and this is the spinel. The spinel is sitting right next door. So as I do this, I have created, in some sense, a relative stress at this interface. And that's, I think, the critical part. We have created a relative stress, and you can calculate or estimate that stress from this displacement that you have. And so that is of the order of 10 to the 9th pascals. Okay. So if you're an atom sitting on the spinel side of the spins, as this distortion is going through very fast, you are experiencing a dynamic stress in some sense. So this lattice is then being either... is being extended with respect to this frame. So that the spinel lattice is then either distorting this way or being compressed. Okay. And that is then coupling in to the magnetostriction in the spinel phase to give you some magnetoelastic energy. So you've taken ferroelastic energy, which is due to the switching process, converted it through this interface, into magnetoelastic energy. Okay, that's the amount of energy you're instantaneously dumping into this nanopillar. Then the question is, what does that energy have to overcome to switch the polarization, to magnetization? Of course, the usual sets, right? You have shape anisotropy, you have magnetocrystal anisotropy, and you have the anisotropy which is built in because this is now stretched as a pillar. Okay, and it turns out that tomorrow we will go through the actual calculations. All of those numbers are much smaller than the magnetoelastic energy that you have dumped into this nanopillar through the switching. Okay. So if you do that, then you can say, aha, I now have a way of putting in enough energy to overcome this energies that are required to switch. What we don't understand at this point is, okay, I know that I need 10 to the 5 joules per centimeter cubed, and I'm putting in 10 to the 7. But that doesn't tell me why it will not go from this state back to this state or whether it will go back to the original state. It doesn't tell me why there is this deterministic behavior that if the magnetization is this way, it will switch to the other state. What gives that? We don't understand that. So we understand the macroscopic part of it. We don't understand the microscopic part of it. The other thing is, obviously, we can't do the opposite. Right? We know that already. So if I apply a magnetic field to a ferromagnetic matrix, you should not be able to switch the ferroelectric, that's for sure. Because the energy scales, you can just work it backwards. Energy scales don't match up. Yeah, but we don't understand how, yeah, how it happens. Yeah. And for that, I think we need some time-resolved experiments, which is what we're hopefully setting up over the next few months. Oh, absolutely. Sorry, that's a good point. I totally forgot to make this point. But there's nothing to do with spinels and perovskites. You can take any spinel and any perovskite as long as they obey this few rules, basically, that they have some crystal chemistry which is driving them, this heteroepitaxy which gives them a framework to grow in a certain orientation. You can do that. As a matter of fact, we have other nanostructures where you can take some perovskites and decompose them, and they will form spontaneously single crystals of iron, which are grown in a certain orientation, embedded in a perovskite matrix. Again, it's driven purely by three-dimensional heteroepitaxy. So you can take other spinels. So one of the experiments we're working on is to take one of these frustrated spinels that Arun and his colleague Ashwin have been pushing. Can you change the degree of frustration in one of these triangular lattice spinels by applying electric fields? Can you make it go into a ferromagnetic state, and as soon as you turn off the electric field, it goes back into a non-magnetic state? No. So we can probe the correlated behavior by using these kinds of architecture. Sorry, yeah.
You mentioned on
there
radiation sensing.
Yeah. Oh, infrared radiation sensing, yeah, typically 8 to 12 micron, wherever the atmosphere does not block you. It's mainly for collision avoidance. You know, automobiles have this already on their, in the front fenders. They all have infrared sensors. And of course, our the defense guys like it because of the night vision stuff.
Questions? Let's thank Professor.
Thank you.